who supposedly are going to catch up and surpass the Western powers, the United States, in terms of economics, and they're also developing themselves more militarily. So my question is, is it possible that we would be dominated in the future by a fifth empire coming from the east, by China? Or do we have to say, no, this Edna is the last one. Where we are now is the last one. China is going to fizzle out.
Concern? Now, first of all, good morning, everyone. And since we've explained the concept of the prophecies and visions concerning the empires of the world and the way in which they will find the Jewish people to be a target of the opposition before the coming of the Mashiach. On the other hand, we do have references in the prophets and a general principle that all prophecies concerning doom and trouble can be transformed to the opposite, through the power of Teshuvah. And perhaps I will mention the final words of the last prophet of Israel, Malachi. It says that there's going to come, I'm going to send Eliyahu Navi, Beshiv Levavot Abanim, and his spirit will bring us Teshuvah to the people of Israel and to the world, and he'll bring back the children of Hashem to go back to accept their Father in heaven. And then in the same verse it says, lest I come and bring complete destruction upon the world. Penavo viketi et haaretz cherem. Cherem means complete destruction. So, first of all, there's a question here on an oral interpretation of all prophecies, which is that no prophecy ends on a note of doom. And this prophecy prophesies doomsday, as it's called today. And we all have blinkers, for Hashem. We don't know really all the dangers that face life on this planet. But those that do investigations, they all say, you know, doomsday surrounds us. It's a miracle we've survived till now against the doomsday syndrome. What's the doomsday? the type of weapons and type of movements of hatred and Cold War and Warmer War that are spread all over the earth. It's becoming a great threat. So the answer is to this, it really lies in the word pen, because they're two words for something that might happen. Pen means something we don't want to happen. And when it says a phrase like lule, or I could say in Hebrew, halavai, these are also possibilities that might happen, but they're things that we hope to happen. Lule hemanti, I have to use the phrase lule frequently in the Tanakh. Pen is something you don't want, lule is something you do want, which you're not sure about. So therefore, Hashem is saying there will come a power of teshuva lest the worst thing happens. And because there's a suspect of the worst thing happening, that brings people to recognize you've got to change. And who's going to teach this to people? We, the people of Israel. So I'll quote again what I said yesterday, now I know more clearly who it was said, when it was said, but right at the conclusion of the Second World War, Stalin and Eisenhower, they made a declaration. They said, unfortunately, we had no choice. We had to do it. We dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But now we have a great responsibility. How are we going to change the world? The world won't go into an arms race of non-conventional weapons. They saw this coming. So they said, we hope that the Jewish people, that they're the ones who will teach us. At the time, there were even Stalin, we know what happened to him afterwards, but so let's not go into that. But at that time, they felt the enormous responsibility for all life on this planet. And who's supposed to solve it? We, the Jews. And they're quite right, because that's our purpose. And I would even go further and say, why did Hashem help us in a miraculous manner to come back to our homeland at a time when Hashem also knew that the Muslims were regarding the land as being theirs, which is already mentioned also in the ancient traditions, that Ishmael does have a portion in this land. Because we have to face the challenge to create peace between all groups of mankind. He wants us to create peace between Muslims and Jews, between Christians and Christians, their enemies, between the Western world and the Middle East and Far Eastern threats. So therefore, the Rambam says another great principle, I mean, he crystallizes it, it's clear in all the traditions. Any dangers, we can call it negative acts of God, as they call it, acts of God, things that can happen. And also even human efforts to increase warfare, increase hatred. All these things, Hashem has made man the one to look after this world and to make sure this planet will be a Gan Eden. And the only way to, we have to demonstrate that the only way to do it is by keeping His Torah. His Torah for the Gentiles is also to be brought to the non-Jewish world through the people of Israel. In other words, Hashem brought it directly to Noah, directly to Adam. It, sparks of it are in each human soul deep down, but to bring it into a plan to change the world for the better, as it comes from the people of Israel. And that's what's happened. That's said all the prophets. It has happened. Because the United Nations, which goes back to the League of Nations, which goes back to a group of scholars who produced what's known the concept of international relations, and even they introduced international law, where did they take it from? They took it all from the Bible, they took it all from the Talmud, they took it from the Rambam. That's where they got it from. And that's how it came to the nations of the world. And even now, until today, this is not just a coincidence, but this has come through scholarship. On the Bill of the United Nations, it's got quotations from the prophets, what might happen in this world, through the people of Israel, and through Yerushalayim. So we are the ones, we've got to face the challenge. And the only way it can be done is through the Torah. And if there's anything to prove it, it's all the efforts that non-Torah people are trying to direct the policy of Israel. And they're not mentioning the name of God anymore. At the beginning they did, and then we were successful. The Balfour Declaration was based upon the respect and the meaningfulness of the words of the prophets for the people of Israel, for mankind. But if we're going to leave aside the name of God, we have to insist all the way through, change the national anthem, change the Declaration of Independence, bring the name of God into what you're doing. And the truth is, how was this? This is just a small event that took place recently, which was so eventful and so important. The head commander of the Givati Brigade of the Israeli army, Ofer Winter, he's a religious Jew. And he produced a letter to all those who were going to go to the Battle of Tzuk Eitan, who were under him, and he's noticed he's a very good general. He produced a letter beforehand, based upon the Bible, to all the soldiers. And he permitted also people to come along and get the soldiers to put on tefillin. And we had it on Sukkot, we had also an army, a very prominent army officer, gave a rap. It's got even an organization, Panim, to go and introduce religious concepts into the army. And in some ways, able to do it, in certain ways. This Ofer Winter is a hero. And we had here, so in the government, they objected. They said, how do you allow an officer of the army to go and indoctrinate soldiers with religion? So his response was, the people who are against this, they've never been in battle, and it's true. They've never faced a battle. The main spokesman against all this, they were people who don't know what fighting means when you face threats of death, and how faith in Hashem helps. And the truth is, everyone has said this. There was a prime minister at the time of what was known as the earthquake following the miracle war, named the Yom Kippur War, where almost 3,000 soldiers were killed. Something like that. It was a very terrible situation. And in the middle of the war, the then Prime Minister, Golda Meir, she gave a talk to English-speaking journalists, primarily Americans and others, in which she quoted the Bible. He said, God will not forsake his people. He said, he's not going to forsake his people, and he's not going to leave aside his inheritance that he's given to the Jewish people, which is the land of Israel. So she said that as an encouragement and hope. So the religious members of Knesset went up to him and said, listen, you said a very good speech to them. Why do you say it in Hebrew? Why do you say it in Hebrew? It's the nation. That's what the nation's waiting for. So she said, well, she's been in politics, a political leader of at that time it was the Marach, the Mapai, who didn't think that you should mention the name of Hashem. And therefore she never mentioned his name in any of her political speeches, because that was their policy. She said, if now in the middle of the war, she'll say it in Hebrew to the people, then the people will say it means we've lost the war. Because if she changes in such a way that she never mentioned anything religious, and now all of a sudden she does, so people who are not yet really following full trust in Hashem, and they're far away from it, and some are opposed to it, so they're going to say, well, it means she's lost her mind. Therefore, we're in a hopeless situation. But really, she says, she's always believed in Hashem. And she believes these verses are true. Because deep down, when you're faced with death, the threat of death, as it's well known, the famous statement from the time of Napoleon in the battles, that there's no such thing as atheism or agnosticism in the trenches. No such thing. It doesn't exist. Everyone, when he's faced with the possibility of death, he tries to cling to the straw of Hashem. And there's so many individuals who've been through this process. Thousands of Baalei Tshuva have become Baalei Tshuva as a result of this. But why should we have to be in a situation that people have to be near death before they can recognize Hashem? We Jews, from birth, we recognize Hashem. And that's what we've got to spread to the world. Don't wait till you're almost dying. And then sometimes you actually do die before you trust in Hashem, believe in Him. Believe in them and train your children, believe in Him from birth onwards. And then you'll be successful. And that applies to all human beings. And we have to spread this in the world. So this is the general message. But now the other words of the Rambam I do want to say, very important. He says that all the prophecies and all the statements of the sages concerning what is going to happen, we don't really know what they really mean in practice until they happen. All we do know we for sure that if we do teshuva, they won't happen. It said that all over the Tanakh and all over the Midrashim. And if we don't do teshuva, how they'll happen, we don't really know. And I'll say this also particularly about this question. There's a question all the commentators about the four empires. Is what? Which is the third empire, which is the fourth empire? Even the Ramban says that he seems to follow the view that although Yishmael, Islam, is going to be a sort of power, but they'll never have universal power. And the Ibn Ezra, who says the fourth empire is the Islamic empire, he interprets all the passages. The Ibn Ezra was a fantastic Bible commentator. Very deep, very sharp. So he says, the leopard, which we've been discussing, is the third empire, which is most of the commentators, and above all, also the Ramban. He said the fourth empire is the leopard, we already discovered with four wings, we discussed that already quite extensively. So he, the Nether says, this is the Greek and the Roman Empire together. And what's the unifying factor is that the truth is Roman civilization, which expressed itself in building, in controlling, in introducing law and order, and especially also Roman law was a great development. But what are the philosophical sources of the Roman civilization? They come from the Greek civilization. Therefore, the leopard is a reference to the third empire, Greek and Rome together. And certainly historically, which is then the fourth empire? The fourth empire referred to is the Islamic empire, which become very great. Now you ask about China and so on. Look, history has shown until now that even the Ramban and the others, they do say that one of the feet, or at least one of the toes of the fourth empire animal or idol is a reference to Ishmael, who will be like a later development of anti-Semitism from the Roman Empire. I mean, the Romans will take over most of the world, but that will be also part of it. But today, we see that Islam, as trying to make a worldwide empire, there, if we include Iran also in this group, the Iranians also are close to, in their religion, to Islam. So this is the great threat of the world today. And you speak about China and other countries, Pakistan, who knows? We don't know what's going to happen. But as things are today, it would appear even Ezra was right. And there's a similar concept developed by the Arizal. It's also one of the great minds. We know most about the Arizal from his disciple, Chaim Vital. So Chaim Vital says, from the basis of the Zohar and the Arizal, there'll be a fifth empire. He goes according to the view of the fourth empire is the Roman Empire, and the fifth one is the Islamic Empire. And the Rambam himself, he doesn't go into this in too many areas, but he does explain passages in the Prophets and in Tehillim, following the trend that in certain ways the power of Ishmael and Islam will be more anti-Semitic and cruel than even the Roman Empire. But all these things, the Rambam says, we'll only know when it happens. So, from all this discussion, I'd like now, I've given you these pages, I want to continue with page Chof Aleph, to how this all affects the concept, the way the Maral has explained so far, that the third empire is the Greek Empire, and the Greek Empire, from a point of view of wisdom, was on the highest level of mankind, Yesh Chochma Bakoim Ta'amin, and has spread knowledge going all the way through till our own day, because it's quite true there are very many men of letters of Roman civilization who developed Greek philosophical and moral concepts. That's well known, it goes on until today. Also in Christianity, which is an outflow of the Romans, there's a lot of philosophical and moral literature they've developed. And that's Yish Chochma Bagoyim. And that's why they found, to some extent, their opposition, if they were not ready to be subservient to like Alexander the Great, and like many others that followed him, but so many others said, no, Judaism is inferior to Christianity. As you know, even, let's say, biblical criticism is based primarily upon the Christian concept that Judaism must be inferior to Christianity. And therefore, in order to explain many things in the Bible, they had to make Bible criticism the only way. Otherwise, there are prophecies in the Bible that surely show us that Judaism is the correct religion and pure monotheism is the correct religion. But to be able to change that was easier with biblical criticism. We're not surprised that there are all types of critics who, especially coming from Germany, where there's an anti-Semitic spirit, as well as the spirit, Western civilization is certainly greater than Jewish civilization, and Christianity is greater than Judaism. So, however, from the Bible we see the opposite, so therefore they say, we'll cut the Bible in pieces. And the decimation of the Bible in pieces was also a method of afterwards trying to decimate the body of the Jewish people and kill them. He says, there was a Jewish scholar who said, quite rightly, who knew the Christian biblical criticism, there's such a thing as higher biblical criticism. Higher biblical criticism, he says, is higher anti-Semitism. That's what's true. Quite true, and that's why it developed greatly in Germany. And it's a great pity that we see that there's so many Jewish assimilated scholars also who go and know very little, really, about the deeper concepts of the Bible, and they go and give lectures based upon anti-Semitic and negative biblical criticism. Now, he had here in the yeshiva, Bochum, who went to courses, even the Jewish age, sent the courses, yeah, you can learn Bible at the Hebrew University. They come here, they come all twisted, they hardly know Hebrew, but they already know the documentary theory, which is an artificial Germanic splitting up of the words of the Bible, the Holy Bible, and splitting it up in such a way to go and transform it. In fact, they even produced a rainbow Bible, which each source was given a different color. So this is what we're faced with today. And that's one of the problems. You see, Hebrew University took as its motto, it says, Lo b'choach, lo b'chai, lo b'choach kim bruach. The symbol of the menorah is described by the prophet Zechariah, Lo, not with force and not with strength, but by my spirit, speaking in Baruchi Amar Hashem, with my spirit. And the menorah expresses the spirit of Hashem, of God. So what are these agnostic, so-called Bible scholars, but really Bible destroyers, what did they do? Yeah, at Hebrew University also, they employ such people. Their motto is just changing a yud. Other, we've got to spread the spirit of the Jewish people. They say the spirit, but leave out the yud. They don't want to recognize the spirit as the God spirit. It says Kim Bruchi. So they change it. And of course, this concept of changing Pesukim is one of the regular ways of introducing agnosticism into the Jewish religion and the Jewish culture. And I was shocked when I came here to Israel the first time. And I saw a big parade. Wasn't the first visit. I saw a parade, a Yom HaTzimut parade, where they changed the pasuk. This is the day that the army has created. Let's rejoice with them. They take a pasuk. The pasuk says, Zehayom asa Hashem. Hashem did it. After the Six-Day War, the truth is that even those who never mentioned it, Hashem, they all quoted this pasuk. They said it came from Hashem. They couldn't explain it differently. But at that parade, they forgot it. So we've got the point of the menorah, and the point of Chanukah is Beruchi. That's the concept of the menorah. And that's why I want to go on now here in the Maral's insights. And I've explained to you before, the Maral is really the basis for deeper Hasidic interpretations, as well as Musa interpretations. So if you look at the beginning, I'd like you to have the text available. You can learn a little bit of Hebrew also. It's a nice print, and you can write notes on it, the translation. He says, Malchut Yavan. As we explained, the empire of Ionia, here Yavan today is called Ionia, but that's the same as Yavan, who Muhan Litnaket Yisrael, they have an inner power and interest, motivation to oppose Israel. The top line of Chof Aleph. Another one. Whoever doesn't have, please take one. It's the aspect that they have Torah and mitzvot which are divine. Because attached to Greek civilization, the empire, is the pursuit of wisdom. But only the intelligence of the human being. And one of the greatest philosophers of Greek, which expresses perhaps in just in a few words, the essence of the Greek spirit, that man is the measure of all things. If you want to know truth, you have to just analyze the human being, his body and his soul and his mind. But that's only the human mind. But to introduce a seichel ha'eloki ha'nivdal, but to say that such a thing as a divine power of intelligence, which is absolute. Nivdal means it's separate. Some people would call it transcendental existence of God. This concept of Nivdal is connected with, let's say there are two basic concepts of God's existence. One is immanent, that means that God is within nature, which has many forms. It's got a form of animism of ancient times, then pantheism, also developed animism. Animism says there's in every material things there's also anima as a soul. There's also a spiritual aspect. Even plants have a certain spiritual aspect in that they've got a power of growth and reproduction, which is the basic element of the plant world. Then you have all living beings that, in addition to having an inner power of life, of growth and reproduction, they also have an inner power that they've got senses whereby they can see and feel and hear other things. They've got, some have even senses that are better than the senses of the human being. They can hear things beyond the range of the human being. Some can see things, like birds, beyond the range of ordinary human eyes. So therefore, they do have senses, and they have power of mobility. That's a life power. You can't just refer to that as being pure chemical elements that work together. There's something more here. It's the animal power. And then you have the human beings also got intelligence. And then the human being has something more. That's what we say, got even more than intelligence, it's got a lot of different powers. But to say that there is a power that's immanent in nature, and we can say to a certain extent all science is based upon the concept of nature, the wisdom and the laws of nature with a capital N. So it means that you can't explain anything without a certain power within. So the higher philosophers say, well, that's a concept of God. God is within nature. But God above nature? No, we can't do it. God above time. God who's above infinity and above eternity and above matter and energy. And that they don't accept. Then there are others who say the opposite. They say nature is all material, but God is above the material. These are the deists. And God can't concern himself really with nature and with what's going on in the world. So God is a complete spiritual power. That's the deists. And then you have the pantheists. But the third approach is the approach of the Bible, the approach of Am Yisrael. We say God is both. God is Kadosh and Baruch. And that's clear that Hashem is the power of God above time, space, and above nature, but he constantly is the source of nature as well. He's the source of everything. He's a constant creator. And today, there are many scientists that come near to this concept. They also say that the only way you can explain everything is that God, who is above all the energies, because science itself has gone to the extent to recognize that every aspect of the physical world is based upon a non-physical world, a world of energies, which is not physical. According to the very fine paradoxical but true statement of Whitehead, one of the founders of modern philosophy of science, he said, the concrete world has slipped through the scientific net. Doesn't exist anymore, the concrete world. Because from the point of view of the scientific world, we know that science shows us that what we think is stationary is moving fast. What we think is solid matter, like the table, it's not. It's just energy. It appears to us as though we're sitting still in this room. It's not true. We're moving at an enormous pace, but we just don't feel it. That's how it's worked out. And if you think the table is solid, it seems to be, it's concrete, it's solid, but it's not at all. These are the atoms, the nuclear and electron, moving within the wood of this table at an enormous rate. And basically the table is energy, it's all energy. So therefore, the science is coming near to the concept, which is referred to in traditional Torah literature as Hashem sovev kol almin or mamale kol almin. He surrounds and is beyond all the worlds that exist that we can have a concept of, all the different types of existence. He fills them all, because he's the source of the existence, but he's also beyond all of them. At the same time, that's what the Maharal refers to as Seich HaNivdal. It's separate from the world. It's referred to on a deeper level. When we refer to Hashem, we say to him, we say, Hashem is Kadosh Baruch. Baruch Hashem Imkom. First we say Kadosh Kadosh. Kadosh means to be separate. Hashem is separate above the world, above the human world of time, space and matter, above everything human being knows. Hashem is above them, Kadosh. But it's also Baruch Hashem, he's blessed. He's blessed, that means we can see Hashem in the world. That's Mamale Kol Almin. So this, the Maharal calls it Seichel HaElokei HaNivdal. That is the concept of the Torah. The Divine Torah tells us from Hashem himself how we should direct the world. Seichel HaNivdal Elokei Loma V'chen El Beit HaMikdash. Now the Beit HaMikdash, the whole concept of Beit HaMikdash is that it represents in the material world also the non-material world. When we say the Holy of Holies, whether it was the Aron HaKodesh, represents the highest level of the inner connection which the human mind can have with God, who is Holy of Holies, who is above everything else, above the material world. So Beit HaMikdash, where we bring offerings to Hashem, which the human being is there with his animal nature to offer his animal nature to Hashem. It's got the concept of Kedusha, which is the level beyond man. So the Greeks find in the Beit HaMikdash their greatest opponent. In contrast to Alexander the Great, who when the high priest gave even his priestly garments, and he knew he was the one who brings offerings in the Beit HaMikdash, he prostrated himself in front of him. In contrast to the time of Shlomo HaMelech, when there came also different wise people from the other nations at the time of the Beit HaMikdash to bring their offerings, they recognized Kedusha. The Greeks wanted to remove this power from the people of Israel. Ke'atorah o Beit HaMikdash hem shtei madrekot zu al zu. We know that the Torah, which is the literature we study, both the written and the oral tradition, and the Beit HaMikdash, which is the concrete expression of that literature, of the divine intelligence, they are two levels, one on top of the other. Where do we see it? Could we find constantly, also in Pirkei Avot, in the fifth chapter, but also elsewhere, B'chol Makom, Shnaim Eilu B'yachad. We say, Yiraton Lefanecha, we say, may it be your will, Shibone Beit HaMikdash, Bimheru Menu, Shibone Beit HaMikdash, Bimheru Ve'yomeinu, V'sen Chalkeinu, V'torah Te'yecho. You know the Nigun? Join in. Shibone Beit HaMikdash, Bimheru Ve'yomeinu, V'sen Chalkeinu, V'torah Te'yecho. Shibone Beit HaMikdash v'mehiru v'yameinu v'ten chalkeinu v'torah te'yehu. Shibone Beit HaMikdash v'mehiru v'yameinu v'sei chalkeinu v'sayru z'echo. Shibone Beit HaMikdash v'mehiru v'yameinu v'sei chalkeinu v'sayru z'echo. Yitzh Hashem, you can hear this song being sung by far better voices than we have at the moment, including myself. What lies behind? Why do these things go together? We hope that it will be rebuilt, and you'll give us our portion in the Torah, because the Torah is the level of Kedusha. It's got holiness. Holiness means the basis of Torah is beyond time, space, causality, and energy that lies in the Torah as far as it applies to our life. And that was represented more concretely by the Beit HaMikdash. Now somebody would say, why don't we, like for example, there's a certain person, in fact, I'll tell you who it was, I think he doesn't mind us saying this, the one who developed Skype, called the Perlmeister, he's an Australian Jew, became a billionaire, when he sold Skype. And he had the idea, he wanted to build the Beit HaMikdash. He even gave talks about it. He wanted to make Jerusalem the center of the world. I think he would build the Beit HaMikdash. But he gradually found out more about Judaism. By the way, our Australian representative in Sydney, he's from there, knows him quite well. It's Chaim Ingram. And he gave a few talks here, and some people from the Shiva spoke to him about it. So now he realizes that we can't do it. Yeah. But there are many people, therefore he wants to make Jerusalem the world tourist center. He's working in that direction. And he realizes we've got to bring Am Yisrael to Teshuvah. Because many people say, why can't we build the Beit HaMikdash? People say in halacha there are problems about it, certainly, halachic speaking, we can't do it. But some people, you know, they don't know so well all the halachic aspects. They say, let's build it. Yeah, and that's one of the problems. What's going on now with the Arabs? Because they're afraid there are some Jews who want to remove the mosque and build a temple. See? So it makes them very upset. The whole their whole. Religious concept. that Islam has to rule. But we've spoken about this all before. Anyway, the din is, we cannot build a Beit HaMikdash. And why not? Because Hashem says, what do you mean? In fact, it would be such a political mistake to even consider a plan of building Beit HaMikdash, like also the Sanhedrin, as long as the Jewish people as a whole, or the majority of them, are not religious. So the Beit HaMikdash becomes a farce. It becomes impure. Of course it becomes impure. What do you mean? People think Beit HaMikdash is there. It's there, it's true. It's there for the time when politics will be directed by the Torah. But as long as the people don't believe in the Torah and don't follow it in their lives, it can't be done. That's what we say. Ten Chalkeinu b'Toratecha is a substitute. We have to fulfill our portion in the Torah, each one of us, to come as far as each one of us can in fulfilling the Torah in our lives. Because even when the first sanctuary was built, Hashem said, Vasuli Mikdash, yes, make for me Mikdash, the sanctuary, b'shachanti b'tocham, so that I will dwell amongst the people of Israel. So people have to have an aim. I want my life to be filled with godliness. I want my life to be filled with Torah or mitzvot. Then I can be, as it were, an example of the essence of the Beit HaMikdash. If you have that, then the Beit will take on meaning. There's a lot of meaning in all these things. And as a recent Baal Teshuva, a great Baal Teshuva, was Andrei Baruch. He was the professor of psychology and psychiatry at Sorbonne University, and he became Baal Teshuva. And he describes the significance of animal sacrifice, which was instituted to replace human sacrifice. And he says, today, unfortunately, the rule of the world is human sacrifice, of the destructive world. They think for their aims, whatever they may be, they're going to kill human beings, and that's a great danger. It's happened in the instincts of the human being. And it's corrupting mankind in the divine image. And the concept of using animals for human purposes lies at the root of the animal soul of the human being being channeled towards holiness instead of towards self-destruction of the human race. The suicide syndrome, which exists today, is a danger. Because not only aspect of individual suicide, it's spreading to become a concept of national suicide, and who knows, international suicide. And the world is racing towards it. They're so stupid. The world, once they become infected with this terrible disease, that why did they take notice, as they did straight after the expression of Stalin and Eisenhower at the end of the World War II. It's a terrifying situation. The only thing that can change it is that can change it. So let's all work in that direction. Any questions?
I have a question about what you say about men. It's always something to tell everybody. But inside man, a man says, if he does something wrong, inside he's shalem. He just said, he's going to make tshuva. But anybody with inside is not tukim, inside, he's not all inside, and he's not going to bother him. He's just going to carry on how he was before and go along with his animal's instincts.
So we believe that ultimately, every human being is created in the divine image. And certainly the Jews not only created in the divine image, but we have this cultural tradition of developing our lives to feel that we're in the divine image. And it does exist in the soul of the Jewish people strongly, but we have to develop it. We don't do enough. I mean, we're coming near now to the Shulshim of what happened on our street. So it's written in the prophets as well, by the first temple, by the second temple, that Hashem brought punishment upon some of the big saints. Which we say, these saints, they tried their best, but perhaps they didn't do quite enough. We say the Asara Harayu Malchut, the 10 great saints who were cruelly killed, the most cruel manner possible, by the Romans, came to atone for the 10 brothers, the sons of Yaakov, who also wanted to kill Yosef, which is discussed. In other words, it's the spirit of egoism at various levels, which is too strong amongst the people of Israel, and often causes disputes, which are not for the sake of heaven. And so Hashem takes the biggest saints, so the rest of the people will take notice, as took place at the consecration of the first sanctuary. Two sons of Aaron were killed from a divine death. The simple explanation of the verses is they wanted to bring an offering which is not commanded by Hashem. They thought they could offer themselves to Hashem according to their ideas, rather than following Hashem exactly. They were very superb religious people, but they didn't have sufficient consideration. They were young and impetuous. They thought they got religious ideas which were not commanded by Hashem. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is that to be krovai kadesh, Hashem said, those who are near to me are be sanctified. Those that are near to me, like Moshe Rabbeinu, was also punished terribly. For him, it was a terrible punishment. He couldn't go into Eretz Israel. All the time he's talking about, let's reach this land. It's such a beautiful land. He wasn't allowed in because of a small aspect, not doing enough Kiddush Hashem. So we see Hashem expects from the greater a person is, the more he expects from him. And certainly Hashem says today you see, in fact, today you see what can be done if you're really outgoing and you learn enough that you can teach others and you do your best to be the kind of others. I've seen it. Doesn't matter where a person is. Let's say, I think that take a person who's known to be so anti-religious. If I would have time, I wouldn't have so many other responsibilities. I know, because I've had done it before. Hashem gave me at a certain time the possibility to give a fortnightly shiur to the president of Israel. And he changed, became more religious. I don't know how far it went. It had an impact. You have to have shiurim in the Knesset. You have to have shiurim in all these different people. But you know, it's a person has to recognize what there is primary, what priority debts he has to do. So that's why I thought in these years I want to try and train the students here and my children. They should all become kiruv workers. They should all go into kiruv. I could do a bit myself, but I want them to do much more. They can do much more. And every person has to know you've got to learn enough and also train your character and discipline yourself enough that you have a good impact upon others and take out those who, as we say, there's no such thing as a non-religious person. Israel not yet religious. Ein avak mo'ish lodati. Put you come here, ani dati, ani lodati. I said, Ein avak mo lodati. Ach adain lodati. He doesn't express his religion yet because it hasn't been developed. I should give the example of Golda Meir. I'm sure the more people working on her, she would have become religious. And I'm sure at the end of their life, nearly all of them become religious. I remember when I first came to Israel, I came with a group of young rabbis and we interviewed all the different heads of the parties. And the head of the Communist Party was a person called Moshe Sneh. So I still remember my arguments with him. And he believed in totalitarianism of the communists, was an atheist. So I said, your name is Moshe Sneh. That's Moshe Rabbeinu, by divine revelation at the bush, Sinai. So I see that you believe in communism like Torah Moshe Emet. You call it Moshe and Sneh. So we had a humorous discussion, but it wasn't humorous. I said to him, communists are bankrupt. You get nothing from it. We discussed the communist ideology. Then I contrasted it with Torah ideology. We had a very good argument. Before he died, he said a confession, and he asked his son to say Kaddish for him. And his son became a traditional Jew. Traditional Jew also was a member of Knesset. And the Bucha, he did the Shuvah. And the same, I'm almost sure, with enough activity from Kiruv workers, you can conquer the Jewish world today. And if you conquer the Jewish world, make Kiddush Hashem, then you can spread, conquer spiritually the whole world. That's it. That's our challenge of each one of us. So therefore you have to learn, and you learn in order to teach and to take and to participate in the shurim as well. That's why do I give you these texts? I've got students who are great in Kiruv, yeah, some of them in different ways, and they took notes. And they, you know, whatever shurim they had, they took notes, and they tried, and then they used them afterwards to teach. There were different colleges, and they taught others. So you can all do that in different ways. Each one should work hard at it. You can reach a high level of being partners in the future redemption. So keep these pages, and you know, continue to translate. Words you don't know, you can write in the English at the side. And also, there's this beautiful English translation. What we're doing, you'll find in the what's called the mitzvah candle, we called it. No. I left it here especially for all of you to use. And if you see it, I'd like to get it back just to have another glance at it. It's a brilliant translation commentary on what we're studying by Malin.